97.9 FM and 1360 AM WCHL and UNC School of Media and Journalism present Sports Focus with Charlie Tuggle. Sports Focus is dedicated to in-depth examination of issues of overriding importance in the sports world. Each week, we'll discuss problems and look for solutions in professional, collegiate, and amateur sports. From Carroll Hall on the Carolina campus, here's your host, journalism professor Charlie Tuggle.
Welcome to Sports Focus. Our topic today, the state of college athletics in the U.S. Our guest, Andy Zimbalist, co-author of the new book, Unwinding Madness, What Went Wrong with College Sports and How to Fix It. Andy is a sports economist and professor at Smith College in Massachusetts. Andy, last week we interviewed your co-author, Gerald Gurney, and I wanted to follow up with you, especially because an article appeared this week in Inside Higher Ed. So this is something that's gaining some traction in the higher education community. So the writer of the article pulls out this summary. A new book argues that the NCAA has lost its way in governance of intercollegiate athletics and is incapable of achieving reform. Is that overstated, or is that one of the main premises of your book?
I think it's accurate. Basically, what we believe, and the three of us who co-authored the book have been studying college sports for about three decades and been involved in it administratively in various ways. We feel that the NCAA has become, in essence, a trade association of athletic directors, coaches, and conference commissioners. Presidents have basically abandoned direct involvement, basically abandoned any effort to articulate college sports within the framework of the primary educational mission of the university. And that, in fact, the NCAA has just drifted further and further apart from that fundamental concept of education being primary. And one of the key steps along the way was in 1996 when they introduced divisional autonomy in governing the NCAA. And what happened is an organization or an association that used to fundamentally be governed by a mass assembly where each school, whether they were Division I, II, or III, had one vote, became segmented into three separate organizations, Division I, II, and III. And within Division I, it became separated into three subdivisions. And within the three subdivisions, first the FBS, the old 1A, and then the Power Five conferences, in each of the creation of new organizational bodies, the first Division I people were given majority representation on association-wide boards. Then within Division I, FBS was given majority representation. Within FBS, the Power Five were given that. So basically, the decision-making process has been freed up over the years to be dominated by those schools that are commercially most committed and most implicated in the governance of college sports. All of that is in the larger context of fundamentally athletic directors and coaches and conference commissioners being the ones who are making decisions. And so it's very hard, given that context, given that historical evolution, to imagine that all of a sudden the NCAA is going to wake up and say, oh, we have a mission. It's all over our rules and regulations that says that education is supposed to be primary and that athletics is supposed to be subordinate to the educational mission. All of a sudden, they're going to wake up and behave differently than they've behaved every year since 1905 when it was created. We don't think so. At the same time, we think that there are, both on the legal front and on the economic front, and by any standard set of ethical principles, the organization is failing, and fewer schools are able to keep up with the 20 or so schools at the very top of the FBS that manage to have an operating surplus from one year to the next. You've got 1,100 school-plus schools in the NCAA, and you've got 20 that are generating an operating surplus on an operating basis. And that means that when we say operating basis, it means that most capital costs, that is to say facility construction and maintenance costs, are not being included. If you include those, now you're down to single digits of the number of athletic programs around the country that actually produce either a balanced budget or a surplus.
So you mentioned 1996. I want to jump back a little bit before that to ask if the ruling by the Supreme Court in 84 set up what happened in 96.
Well, I think everything that happened before 1996 set up what happened in 1996. But clearly, the 1984 Supreme Court decision in Oklahoma v. NCAA, which was a Supreme Court ruling basically that said that the existing television framework that the NCAA used to sign national television contracts for the broadcasting of football, that was a restraint of trade, that it was illegal, that it violated our nation's antitrust laws. And so that after that decision was taken, it was no longer possible for the NCAA to sign one contract with CBS that would say, you know, no school could be on more than twice in any given season. Whoever was on television, whether it was Oklahoma or whether it was Appalachian State, no matter how popular or successful the program, everybody got paid the same amount for being on national television. That was a contract that the NCAA had established. It was, the basis for that contract was first established in the 1950s, but with a few tweaks, basically, it continued until 84. And 84 said, the Supreme Court said, no, from now on, the NCAA can't do that anymore. It can't behave as a television cartel. Television contracts henceforth will be signed by either conferences or by the schools themselves, by the universities themselves. And that let loose a dynamic wherein the conferences rejiggered themselves, realigned themselves in such a way as to maximize their television audience. And so the historical basis for forming conferences, which had to do with geographical proximity and educational affinity, the schools that basically had similar levels of educational excellence, that historical basis for conference formation was thrown out the window in favor of a new basis, which was, let's maximize our television contracts. And so that was, I think it was a very key moment in the evolution of commercialization in the NCAA. It certainly increased the momentum towards commercialization, increased the incentives to schools to try to be successful commercially and economically. It decreased the incentives to maintain educational primacy. And it vastly increased the amount of inequality from one school or one conference to the next, and has yielded today the current situation that I alluded to already, which is that there are really only a handful of schools that are making this thing work economically. The other schools are trying to keep up, and they're losing more and more money. The largest deficit on an operating basis in the NCAA in 2015 was about $45 million. That's $45 million that's being taken away from the educational budget. So it's not working on a financial level. It's not working ethically. The students who are playing top-level men's basketball and football, the majority of them are minorities who are being exploited by the schools. Most of them are not getting what anybody would consider to be a sound education. Most of the large numbers of them don't even end up with a degree.
And we'll get into some of those topics when Sports Focus returns. Welcome back to Sports Focus. We're talking with Andy Zembelist, co-author of the book Unwinding Madness. You and your co-authors really get into coaching salaries, and that the salaries go to people who aren't producing the product. But isn't that the case, that the CEO of the company winds up making a lot of money when it's the workers who produce the product? So what's the difference between coaches in college athletics and CEOs of big companies?
That's a good question. Well, look, first of all, even though you and I and somebody in your listening audience might have disagreements about how much the workers get paid in a typical corporation, you know, maybe they get a $30,000 annual salary, maybe it's $90,000, depending on what corporation it is and what kind of work they do. The fact of the matter is that in each case, they get paid. And they get paid according to principles that are established by supply and demand in the marketplace. The corporations you allude to don't belong to trade associations that decide, hey, we've got an idea. Let's increase our profits. Let's fatten our bottom line by not paying our workers. If corporations in America did that, Then I would say, well, we have to deal with CEO compensation. It's not fair that CEOs are getting tens of millions of dollars a year and their workers are getting paid nothing. That's what's happening in college football and college basketball, right? The NCAA is a cartel in many respects, and it sets rules. And one of those rules is that they supposedly adhere to principles of amateurism, and those principles dictate that the starting quarterback and the starting left guard and the starting receivers can't get paid anything. They can get a free education, but they can't get paid anything above and beyond that. Same thing with the basketball team. So what ends up happening is that you have an artificially generated, and what many would argue is an illegal set of institutions that are preventing the players from being paid. And because the coaches don't have to pay the players, but they recruit the players, they get paid for the value that the players are producing. And that's why you have the anomaly that, you know, somebody like Jim Harbaugh at the University of Michigan got paid $9 million last year. Or Rick Pitino on a regular basis might be getting $7, $8, $9, $10 million. John Calipari, and on the list goes. Why is it that these guys are getting paid that amount of money? If you look at the typical NBA team, and you compare the revenue of the average revenue of the 30 NBA teams with the average revenue of the top 30 teams in Division I in the NCAA. So it's an apples-to-apples comparison. You're just looking at the top 30 NCAA basketball teams. You see that the average revenue for those basketball teams in the NCAA is somewhere in the neighborhood of $20 million, maybe even less than that. Maybe it's $16 or $17 million. The average revenue of the NBA teams is up around $200 million. So you have a factor of 8, 9, 10 to 1. The NBA teams are generating more revenue, and there's a similar thing going on with the NFL. Yet, even though the average NBA team might be generating 8, 9, 10 times the amount of revenue as a Power 5 conference basketball team, the coaches are getting paid the same amount. Because if you look at the coaches' salaries in the NBA, you see that they're getting the same kind of salaries that Calipari and Pitino and others are getting. They're getting $5, $6, $7, $8 million a year. So how could that be? How would any normal economic situation have that result where the head of an organization that generates $20 million in revenue is getting paid the same as another organization that produces the same, basically the same product, and has $200 million in revenue, and the heads are getting paid the same amount? The only reason why you have that anomalous outcome is because the basketball and the football players in college aren't getting paid. Now, there's one further thing that I think is important to say about this, which is that if you or I, Charlie, were to be king of the world, and we waved our wand and we said, okay, heretofore, we will not allow a college coach to be paid $1 more than a college president, which, by the way, Bear Bryant, the old very successful coach at University of Alabama, he had a rule that he wouldn't get paid more than $1 less than the college president because he thought it was unseemly, it was inappropriate, sent the wrong message. The college president's the most important person on the campus, not the football coach. But in any event, suppose we said that. Suppose all of a sudden we passed a rule and it said, you know, if the college president gets $600,000, head of the football team, head coach can't get, and basketball team, they can't get more than $600,000. So if you pass that rule, what do you think would happen to the quality of coaching in college sports? Answer, not one thing. Why? Because if Rick Pitino and John Calipari can't coach at the top level in college sports, what are they going to do? These are guys who have... Most of them have bachelor's degrees. A few might have some master's degrees. They're not going to go out and become rocket scientists or engineers for software companies. Maybe some of them would get jobs coaching at the FCS level or in Division II or Division III or high school, God forbid. But they're not going to make more than $600,000. And so if you said to them, you can't get paid more than $600,000, they're going to still allocate their talent towards coaching in college, because that's the best alternative they have. And this phenomenon is called economic rent. Economists call it economic rent. And it's a payment to a resource that has some kind of monopoly control over the market that is over and above what you'd have to pay that resource to get it to allocate its resources to that activity. So when we give Calipari $5 or $6 or $7 million. And we really only have to give them whatever it might be, $500,000, to convince them to coach in college. All of the difference is economic rent. We don't have to be paying him that. We could still have the same level of coaching and the same quality of basketball in the NCAA. So there, for a variety of reasons, the payment schemes that exist are ethically unacceptable, that here athletes not getting paid and the coaches are walking off as multimillionaires. Economically, it makes no sense. It sends the wrong signal to the school and to the students about what's important at this school. Is it the professors and the educational process? Is it the college president? Or is it the guy who coaches the football team? So I think on all of these levels, you know, there are important differences to point out between the coaching salaries in FBS and CEO salaries in American corporations.
Sports Focus. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Sports Focus with Charlie Tuggle. And now back to the show on 97.9 FM WCHL.
Welcome back to Sports Focus and our discussion with Andy Zimbalist about the state of college athletics. And we were talking about coaching salaries. And Andy, we have to get into, all right, how do we change this thing? One thing that you guys have suggested is a limited conditional and limited antitrust exemption from Congress. Do we want lawmakers to get involved in this?
Yes. Yes, I think we do. You know, there's certainly a political wind blowing in the United States that says that anything that Congress touches is going to turn to mud. Either that or it will turn to nothing because they never do anything in Congress these days anyway because of political gridlock. But look, I mean, we live in a democracy, and we should be using our democracy to fashion good social, political, and economic policy. And we need something in college sports because it's being run amok by the NCAA, and the courts don't know what to do with it. Antitrust law is very, very ambiguous. The most recent extant case, the O'Bannon case, this was around payment compensation to college athletes, went up to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court denied cert. They refused to hear the case. The Supreme Court might have, if they heard the case and articulated a clear decision, they might have clarified the principles of how you apply antitrust to college athletics. Right now, the principles are very nebulous. Congress or public policy is the only thing we have left. We've got to learn how to use Congress. We've got to learn how to use our political system, not just to deal with college sports, but we need to use our political system to deal with international treaties, and we need to use it to deal with the climate change. We simply have to learn how to make our system functional. To walk away from it and say that in the past it hasn't been functional, therefore let's forget about it, I don't think helps anybody in the long run. So it's to be sure, it's not a simple process. What we favor in the book, actually, although we lay out a very specific plan, as you allude to, but recognizing that it's very hard to go from step one to step two in simple order, we think that it would make a lot of sense to do what Congress did back in the 1970s. Actually, it was the president who did it. President set up a presidential commission to look at amateur sports in the United States, and they created the Ted Stevens Sports Act, which created the USOC, the United States Olympic Committee, and created a much better governance system for amateur sports in the United States. We think that a presidential commission whereby the president would appoint a handful of experts, independent experts, to study for 6 months or a year the issues behind college sports and to make recommendations about changing the institution so that they work better, that would be a terrific step forward. So something needs to be done in the public policy area. Lots of initial steps could be taken, and I don't think we have enough time to lay out the details of our plan, but by giving the NCAA or another sports governing body an antitrust exemption on the condition that they reestablish the primacy of education over athletics, I think is a good place to begin.
And that does it for this edition of Sports Focus. Thanks to our guest, Andy Zimbalist. Thanks also to producer Caleb Waters. And as always, thanks to you for listening. Cheers.
Thanks to Richard Southall, Mark Nagel, and Deborah Southall at the College Sport Research Institute at the University of South Carolina for their research and guidance and for access to CSRI's international network of sources. Sports Focus is a service of UNC School of Media and Journalism.